Blog Talk Radio.
Truthful.
2. I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service as a member of this country's most agile military force, the Marine Corps. I served in all commissioned ranks from second lieutenant to major general. And during that period, I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and for the bankers. I suspected I was just part of a racket at the time. Now I am sure of it. I helped make Mexico safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys. I helped in the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefits of Wall Street. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers in 1910. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests in 1916. In China, I helped to see to it that Standard Oil went its way unmolested. Looking back on it, I feel I could have given Al Capone a few tips. The best he could do was operate his racket in 3 districts. I operated on 3 continents. A racket is best described, I believe, as something that is not what it seems to the majority of the people. Only a small inside group knows what it is about. It is conducted for the benefit of the very few at the expense of the very many. In the World War, a mere handful garnered the profits of the conflict. At least 21,000 new millionaires and billionaires were made in the United States during the World War. How many of these war millionaires shouldered a rifle? How many of them dug a trench? How many of them knew what it meant to go hungry in a rat-infested dugout? How many of them spent sleepless, frightened nights ducking shells and shrapnel and machine gun bullets? Out of war, nations acquire additional territory if they are victorious. They just take it. This newly acquired territory promptly is exploited by the few, the selfsame few who wrung dollars out of blood in the war. The general public shoulders the bill. It would have been far cheaper and safer for the average American who pays the bills to stay out of foreign entanglements. For a very few, this racket, like bootlegging and other underworld rackets, brings fancy profits. But the cost of operations is always transferred to the people who do not profit. Take the World War. It cost the United States taxpayer some $52 billion, and we haven't paid that debt yet. Ultimately, it's the soldier who pays the biggest part of the bill. If you don't believe this, visit the American cemeteries on the battlefields abroad, or visit any of the veterans' hospitals in the United States. Napoleon once said, "All men are enamored of decorations. They positively hunger for them." So, by developing the Napoleonic system, the medal business, the government learned it could get soldiers for less money. Because the boys liked to be decorated. Until the Civil War, there were no medals. Then the Congressional Medal of Honor was handed out. It made enlistments easier. In the World War, we used propaganda to make the boys accept conscription. They were made to feel ashamed if they didn't join the army. So vicious was this war propaganda that even God was brought into it. With few exceptions, our clergymen joined in the clamor to kill, kill, kill. To kill the Germans, God is on our side. It is His will that the Germans be killed. And in Germany, the good pastors called upon the Germans to kill the Allies, to please the same God. Beautiful ideals were painted for our boys who were sent out to die. This was the war to end all wars. This was the war to make the world safe for democracy. No one mentioned to them as they marched away that their going and their dying would mean huge war profits. Thus, having stuffed patriotism down their throats, it was decided to help make them pay for the war, too. So we gave them the large salary of $30 a month. All they had to do for this munificent sum was to leave their dear ones behind, give up their jobs, lie in swampy trenches, and kill and kill and kill. Be killed. Well, war is a racket, all right. And the only way to smash this racket is to conscript capital, industry, and labor before the nation's manhood can be conscripted. Let all the officers, directors, high-powered executives, all the workers, managers, bankers, and yes, all the generals, admirals, officers, and all politicians, all government office holders, everyone in the nation, be restricted to a total monthly income not to exceed that paid to the soldier. Why shouldn't they? They aren't running any risk of being killed or having their bodies mangled or their minds shattered. The soldiers are. Give capital, industry, and labor 30 days to think it over, and I think you will find by that time there will be no war. Another step necessary in the fight to smash the war racket is the limited plebiscite to determine whether a war should be declared. A plebiscite not of all the voters, but merely of those who would be called upon to do the fighting and dying. There wouldn't be very much sense in having the president of a munitions factory or the head of an international banking firm or the manager of a uniform manufacturing plant, all of whom see visions of tremendous profits in the event of war, voting on whether the nation should go to war or not. They never would be called upon to shoulder arms. Only those who would be called upon to risk their lives for their country should have the privilege of voting to determine whether the nation should go to war. That would smash the war racket. That and nothing else. The next war, according to experts, will be fought not with battleships, not by artillery, not with rifles, and not with machine guns. It will be fought with deadly chemicals and gases. But victory or defeat will be determined by the skill and ingenuity of our scientists. If we put them to work making poison gas and more fiendish mechanical and explosive instruments of destruction, they will have no time for the constructive job of building a greater prosperity for all peoples. By putting them to this useful job, we can all make more money out of peace than we can out of war. So, I say, to hell with war!
Interesting. Major General Smedley Darlington Butler, in 1932, a coup to overthrow the U.S. government by right-winged industrialists was thwarted by Butler when he was asked to lead the new government in 500,000 troops. General Smedley Darling Butler, United States Marine Corps veteran of 33 years, Congressional Medal of Honor in 1914, Congressional Medal of Honor in 1917, Distinguished Service Medal 1919, the Brevet Medal in the Boxer Rebellion in China. Throughout his distinguished brilliant career, Butler demonstrated that true patriotism does not mean blind allegiance to government policies in which one does not agree.
International in scope. It is the only one in which the profits
a reckoning in dollars and the losses in lives. A racket is best described, I believe, as something that is not what it seems to the majority of the people. Only a small inside group knows what it is about. It is conducted by the benefit of the very few at the expense of the very many. Out of war, a few people make huge fortunes. In the World War I, a mere handful garnered the profits of the conflict. At least 21,000 new millionaires and billionaires were made in the United States during the World War. That many admitted their huge blood gains in their income tax returns. How many other war millionaires falsified their tax returns, no one knows. How many of these war millionaires shouldered a rifle? How many of them dug a trench? How many of them knew what was meant to go hungry in the rat-infested dugout? This is basically what our friend just read, all right? But we just read a lot of this from the speech. I'm going to continue to read this first chapter. For a great many years as a soldier, I had a suspicion that war was a racket. And not until I retired to civil life did I fully realize it. Now that I see the international war clouds gathering, as they are today, I must face it and speak out. Again, they are choosing sides. France and Russia met and agreed to stand side by side. Italy and Austria have hurried to make a dissimilar agreement. Poland and Germany cast sheep eyes at each other, and forgetting for the nonce one unique occasion, their dispute over the Polish corridor. Let me just remind you, doesn't this sound just like what happened with Obama trying to scramble around and getting coalition support from Europe? European allies, okay, which was a joke because Britain finally made sense and pulled out of that agreement and said, no, we're not doing anything. And again, the assassination of King Alexander of Yugoslavia complicated matters. Yugoslavia and Hungary, long bitter enemies, were almost at each other's throats, and Italy was ready to jump in, but France was waiting. So was Czechoslovakia. All of them are looking ahead to war. Not the people, not those who fight and pay and die, only those who foment wars and remain safely at home to profit. There are 40 million men under arms in the world today, and our statesmen and diplomats have the temerity to say that war is not in the making? Hell's bells. Are these 40 million men being trained to be dancers? Not in Italy, to be sure. And Premier Mussolini knows what they are being trained for. And he, at least, is fact enough to speak out. Only the other day, Il Duce in International Conciliation, the publication of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, says, and above all fascism, now this is Il Duce talking, Mussolini. It is all above all fascism, the more I consider and observe the future and the development of humanity quite apart from political considerations of the moment, believes neither in the possibility nor the utility of perpetual peace. War alone brings up to its highest tension all human energy and puts the stamp of nobility upon the people who have the courage to meet it. Now, I mean, if that's not crock, I mean, that's what this was all about, folks. That's what this was the heading into World War II. After having just lost a quarter of the population of Europe in World War I, they wanted to go on and destroy the rest. Let me go on to say, undoubtedly Mussolini means exactly what he says. His well-trained army, his great fleet of planes, and even his navy are ready for war, anxious for it, apparently. His recent stand at the side of Hungary as the latter's dispute with Yugoslavia showed that, and the hurried mobilization of his troops on the Austrian border after the assassination of Dollfuss showed it too. And there are others in Europe, too, whose saber-rattling presages war soon or later. Herr Hitler and his rearming Germany and his constant demands for more and more arms is an equal, if not greater, menace to peace. France only recently increased the terms of military service for its youth from a year to 18 months. Yes, all over, nations are camping in their arms. The mad dogs of Europe are on the loose, and in the Orient, their maneuvering is more adroit. And back in 1904, when Russia and Japan fought, we kicked out our old friends, the Russians, and backed Japan. Then our very generous international bankers were financing Japan. And now the trend is to poison us against the Japanese. What does the door open for policy to China mean to this? Our trade with China is about $90 million a year. Or the Philippine Islands, we have spent about $600 million in the Philippines in 35 years. And we, our bankers and industrialists and spectators, have private investments there of less than $200 million. Now, this is interesting. You can imagine, of course, today, the investment in these countries skyrocketed, over $90 billion in Chinese imports every year. Way over $90 billion, right? And just unreal. But then, to save that China trade of our $90 million. Now, I'm going back to the. I don't want to mean to be confusing here, but I am just. We're talking history, and I'm just reading the text of this book, which was written in 1935. Then to save the China trade of about $90 million, or to protect these private investments from less than $200 million in the Philippines, we'd be all stirred up to hate Japan and go to war. A war that might well cost us tens of billions of dollars. Hundreds of thousands of lives of Americans and many more hundreds of thousands of physically maimed and mentally unbalanced men. Of course, for this loss, there would be a compensating profit. Fortunes would be made. Millions and billions of dollars would be piled up by a few. Munitions makers, bankers, shipbuilders, manufacturers, meat packers, speculators. They would fare well. Yes, they are getting ready for another war. Why shouldn't they? It pays high dividends. But what does it profit the men who are killed? What does it profit their mothers and sisters, their wives and their sweethearts? What does it profit their children? What does it profit anyone except the very few to whom war means huge profits? Yes, and what does it profit the nation? Take our own case. Until 1898, we didn't own a bit of territory outside the mainland of North America. At that time, our national debt was a little more than $1 billion. Then we became internationally minded. We forgot or shunted aside the advice of the fathers of our country. We forgot George Washington's warning about entangling alliances. We went to war. We acquired outside territory. At the end of the World War period, as a direct result of our fiddling in international affairs, our national debt had jumped to over $25 billion. Our total favorable trade balance during the 25-year period was about $24 billion. Therefore, on a purely bookkeeping basis, we ran a little behind year for year, and that foreign trade might well have been ours without the wars. It would have been far cheaper, not to say safer, for the average American who pays the bills to stay out of foreign entanglements. For a very few, this racket, like bootlegging and other underworld rackets, bring fancy profits, but the cost of operation is always transferred to the people who do not profit. And doesn't that sound exactly like what's happening again now with all these damn wars that we're in? And, it's just deja vu all over again. Chapter 2, who makes the profits? The World War rather our brief participation in it, has cost the United States some $52 billion. Figure it out. That means $400 for every American man, woman, and child. And we haven't paid the debt yet. We are paying it. Our children will pay it. Our children's children probably still will be paying the cost of the war. And remember, folks, $52 billion in 1935 is probably equal to $52 trillion today. So, anyway, normal profits of a business concern in the United States are 6, 8, 10, and sometimes 12%. But wartime profits, that is another matter. 20, 60, 100, 300, even 1,800%. The sky is the limit. All that traffic will bear. And Uncle Sam has the money. Let's get it. Of course, it isn't put that crudely in wartime. It is dressed into speeches about patriotism, love of country, and we must all put our soldiers to the wheel, our shoulders to the wheel, rather. But the profits jump and leap and skyrocket and are safely pocketed. Let's just take a few examples. Take our friends the DuPonts, the powder people. Didn't one of them testify before a Senate committee recently that their powder won the war? Or save the world for democracy or something. How did they do in the war? They were a patriotic corporation. Well, the average earnings of the DuPonts from the period 1910 to 1914 were $6 million a year. It wasn't much, but the DuPonts managed to get along on it. Now, let's look at their average yearly profit during the war years, 1914 to 1918. $58 million a year profit, we find. Nearly 10 times that of normal times, and the profit of normal times were pretty good. An increase in profits of more than 950%. Take one of our little steel companies that patriotically shunted aside the making of rails and girders and bridges for manufacturing war materials. Well, their 1910 to 1914 yearly earnings averaged $6 million. Then after the war, and like loyal citizens, Bethlehem Steel promptly turned to munitions making. Did their profits jump, or did they let Uncle Sam in for a bargain? Well, their 1914 to 1918 average was $49 million a year. Imagine, folks, going from $6 million to $49 million in 1 year, right? I mean, as your profits, as the American nuts, okay? But that's what people are doing now. Imagine, look at the profits of Halliburton. Look at the profits of everybody in that, you know, of all your war profiteers, all right? Blackwater, so on. Or let's take United States Steel. The normal earnings during the 5 year period for the war was $105 million. Not bad. Then along came the war, and up went the profits. The average yearly profit for the period 1914 to 1918 was $240 million. Not bad. Okay? So in other words, they went from $105 million to $240 million in a year, in those 4 years of war profiteering. There you have some of the steel and powder earnings. Let's look at some else. Little copper, perhaps. That always does well in war times. Anaconda, for instance, averaged yearly earnings during the pre-war years of 1910 to 1914 of $10 million. During the war years, increased to $34 million a year. Yeah. Utah Copper averaged $5 million per year during the war years, during the 1910 to 1914 pre-war years. Jumped in average earnings of $21 million yearly profits to the war period. They doubled, they tripled, quadrupled their average yearly earnings when we went into war. The list goes on and on and on and on. And I won't continue, I don't have to read all of them, it's quite involved. But this entire chapter is showing all the profits of all the different companies, company after company after company that made excessive, extreme profits during the war period. Okay, chapter 3, who pays the bills? Who provides the profits? These nice little profits of 20%, 100%, 300%, 1,500%, 1,800%, right? We all pay them in taxation. We paid the bankers their profits when they bought Liberty bonds at $100 and sold them back at 84 or 86 to the bankers. All right, these bankers collected 100 plus. It was a simple manipulation. The bankers controlled the security markets. It was easy for them to depress the price of these bonds. Then all of us, the people, got frightened and sold the bonds at $84 or $86. The bankers bought them. Then these same bankers stimulated a boom and government bonds went to par and above. Then the bankers collected their profits. But the soldier pays the biggest part of the bill. If you don't believe this, visit the American cemeteries and the battlefields abroad, or visit any of the veterans' hospitals in the United States on a tour of the country, in the midst of which I am in this time. At the time of this writing. I have visited 18 government hospitals for veterans. In them are a total of about 50,000 destroyed men, men who were the pick of the nation 18 years ago. A very able chief surgeon at the General Hospital of Milwaukee, where there are 3,800 of the living dead, told me the mortality among veterans is three times as great as among those who stayed at home. Boys with a normal viewpoint were taken out of the fields and offices, and factories and classrooms, and put into the ranks. There they were remolded. They were made over. They were made to about face, to regard murder as the order of the day. They were put shoulder to shoulder, and through mass psychology, they were entirely changed. We used them for a couple of years and trained them to think nothing at all of killing or being killed. Then suddenly we discharged them and told them to make another about-face. This time they had to go do their own readjustments, sans mass psychology, without mass psychology, sans officers' aids and advice, and sans nationwide propaganda. We didn't need them anymore, so we scattered them about without any three-minute or liberty loan speeches or parades. Too many of these fine young boys were eventually destroyed mentally because they could not make that final about-face alone. In a government hospital in Marion, Indiana, 1,800 of these boys are in pens, 500 of them in a barracks with steel bars and wires all around outside the building and on the porches. These already have been mentally destroyed. These boys don't even look like human beings. On the look of their faces, physically, they are in good shape. Mentally, they are gone. There are thousands and thousands of these cases, and more coming at all times. The tremendous excitement of the war, the sudden cutting off of that excitement, the young boys couldn't stand it. And you know what, folks? I mean, you see it today. Our veterans' hospitals are overloaded. Veterans are, one in four veterans are killing themselves, okay? It's just unbelievable, and nothing has changed. War is hell, and these soldiers are just the fodder, cannon fodder. And then they're let go and not even given benefits, and become homeless. So just and mentally ill. Families are destroyed, lives destroyed, but nobody gives a crap because everybody made money. Right? So many people made big money, okay, and destroyed everything. Now, a guy like Obama, who never even served in the military, can, so quickly decide to invade another country and destroy and kill countless of people and with collateral damage from his drones, and from his insane war plans, okay? he's a nightmare criminal, this guy Obama. A criminal. Just as George W. Bush and his cronies have all been labeled criminals by the work courts. Okay, international courts. You can't even leave the country without being arrested. All right? And as it turns out, just yesterday, just recently, this is the last week, Obama, okay, this mother, son of a bitch, okay, Obama, all right, just gave immunity, okay, to George W. Bush and his entire gang and Dick Cheney and all the criminal bastards, you know, who are now indicted for war crimes around the world. He gave them full immunity here in this country. Fuck you, Obama. You miserable SOB. You can see what Smedley Butler would say today. He'd probably go up and shoot the guy. You know, he'd just go insane with this guy. It was bad enough with all these world wars. But you imagine this guy unconstitutionally just, we're going into this war, we're going to go here, send all these guys, send our National Guard in, just for fun, okay? Fun and excitement of his miserable life up there in the White House there. You know, you can't, the man has 5 or 6 major scandals brewing against him. He's about ready to be impeached if somebody has the balls to do it in our Congress, all right? And, it's just a frightening thing we're dealing with. Smedley Butler saw it all, lived it all back in 1935 and before that. And, here we are again. Just sickening, just absolutely sickening. 75 years later, we're same problem. A different president. Again and again and again and again. I don't know how many wars we've been in since 1935. It just never stops. That is part of the bill. So much for the dead. They have paid their part of the war profits. So much for the mentally and physically wounded. They are paying now their share of the war profits. But the others paid too. They paid with heartbreaks when they tore themselves away from their firesides and their families to don the uniform of Uncle Sam, on which a profit had been made. They paid another part in the training camps where they were regimented and drilled while others took their jobs and their places and the lives of their communities. They paid for it in the trenches where they shot and were. Found that we could reduce the cost of war by taking all the prize money and keeping it. That's right. When we kept, the government and states paid as high as $1,200 for an enlistment. In the Spanish-American War, they gave prize money. When we captured any vessel, the soldiers all got their share. At least they were supposed to. Then it was found that we could reduce the cost of war by taking all the prize money and keeping it, but conscripting, drafting the soldiers anyway. Then soldiers couldn't bargain for their labor. Everyone else could bargain, but the soldier couldn't. Napoleon once said, "All men are enamored by decorations. They positively hunger for them." So by developing the Napoleonic system, the medal business, the government learned it could get soldiers for less money because the boys liked to be decorated. And until the Civil War, there were no medals. And when the Congressional Medal of Honor was handed out, it made entitlements easier. After the Civil War, no new medals were issued until the Spanish-American War. In World War, we used propaganda to make the boys accept conscription, being drafted, and they were made to feel ashamed if they didn't join the army. So vicious was the war propaganda that even God was brought into it, and a few exceptions, our clergymen joined, and the clamor to kill, 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 to kill the Germans. Oh, we are just kill the Germans, kill everybody. I mean, all the way up to now, kill Muslims. You know, kill everybody. God is on our side, and His will that the Germans be killed. It's the same as the Germans or the Muslims or the Vietnamese or the Koreans or North Koreans or. I mean, how many damn enemies have we had, right, in the last 100 years? Such a ridiculous. And in Germany, the good pastors called upon the Germans to kill the Allies. Well, beautiful ideals were painted for our boys who were sent out to die. This was the war to end all wars. This was the war to make the world safe for democracy. No one mentioned to them, and they marched away, that they're going and they're dying would mean huge war profits. No one told these American soldiers they might be shot down by bullets made by their own brothers here. And no one told them that the ships on which they were going to cross might be torpedoed by submarines built in the United States patents. They were just told it would be a glorious adventure. Thus, having stuffed patriotism down their throats, it was decided to make them help pay for the war, too. So we gave them the large salary of $30 a month. And all they had to do for this munificent sum was to leave their dear ones behind, give up their jobs, lie in swampy trenches, eat canned willy when they could get it, and kill and kill and kill and be killed. But wait, half of that wage, just a little more than a riveter in a shipyard or a laborer in a munitions factory, safe at home, made in a day, was promptly taken from him to support his dependents, so that they would not become a charge upon the community. Then they made him pay what amounted to accident insurance, something the employer pays for in an enlightened state, and that cost him $6 a month, and he had less than $9 a month left. Yeah. Now, you know, isn't that amazing? All right, they still do this. They still do this today. They pay the guy shit. Okay, they pay the soldiers crap, all right, and put them out there and take money away and all this kind of stuff, and taxes and every other god-awful thing. You got to get nothing to live on, all right? And what they were making back then in a day, all right, they were paying these guys by the month. Jesus, God, money, all right? I mean, are these guys just suckers or what? And the most crowning insolence of all, he was virtually blackjacked into paying for his own ammunition, clothing, and food for being made to buy Liberty bonds. Most soldiers got no money at all on paydays. We made them buy Liberty bonds at $100, then we bought them back when they came back from the war and they couldn't find work at $84 and $86. The soldiers bought about $2 million worth of bonds, $1 billion worth of these bonds. Yes, the soldiers pay the greater part of the bill. His family pays too. They pay it in the same heartbreak that he does. As he suffers, they suffer at night, and he lay in the trenches and watch shrapnel burst around him. They lay home in their beds and toss sleeplessly. His father, his mother, his wife, his sisters, his brothers, his sons, and his daughters. When he returned home, minus an eye, minus a leg, or with his mind broken, they suffered too, as much as even sometimes more than he. Yes, and they too contributed their dollars to the profits of the munitions makers and the bankers and the shipbuilders and the manufacturers and the speculators made. They too bought Liberty bonds and contributed to the profit of the bankers after the armistice and the hocus pocus of manipulated Liberty bond prices. And even now, the families of the wounded men and the mentally broken and those who never were able to readjust themselves are still suffering and still paying. I mean, doesn't that sound like the same exact thing where it's happening today? Oh, we may be paying them a little more money, but it's still virtually not paying them at all. I mean, private, I think, makes less than $25,000 a year, right? He goes out there and gets his ass blown up, all right? It's like, come on. How to smash this racket? Well, it's a racket, all right. A few profits and the many pay. A few profit and the many pay. But there is a way to stop it. You can't end it by disarmament conferences. You can't eliminate it by peace parleys at Geneva. Well-meaning but impractical groups can't wipe it out by resolutions. It can be smashed effectively only by taking the profit out of war. The only way to smash this racket is to conscript capital and industry and labor before the nation's manhood can be conscripted. 1 month after the government can conscript the young men of the nation, it must conscript capital and industry and labor. Let the officers and the directors and the high-powered executives of our armament factories and our munitions makers and our shipbuilders and our airplane builders and the manufacturers of all the other things that provide war profit in wartime, as well as bankers and the speculators, be conscripted to get $30 a month, the same wage as the lads in the trenches get. Let the workers in these plants get the same wages, all the workers, all presidents, all executives, all directors, all managers, all bankers, yes, and all generals, and all admirals, and all officers, and all politicians, and all government office holders. Everyone in the nation be restricted to total monthly income not to exceed that paid to the soldier in the trenches. Let all these kings and tycoons and masters of business and all those workers in industry and all our senators and governors and majors pay half of their monthly $30 wage to their families and pay war risk insurance and buy liberty bonds. Why shouldn't they? They aren't running any risk of being killed or having their bodies mangled or their minds shattered. They aren't sleeping in muddy trenches. They aren't hungry. The soldiers are. Give capital and industry a labor 30 days to think it over, and you will find by that time there will be no war. That will smash the war racket. That and some nothing else. Maybe I am a little too optimistic. Capital still has some say. So capital won't permit the taking of the profit out of war until the people, those who do the suffering and still pay the price, make up their minds that those they elect to office shall do their bidding and not that of the profiteers. Another step necessary is this fight to smash the war racket is the left plebiscite to determine the limited plebiscite to determine whether a war should be declared. A plebiscite not of all voters, but merely of those who would be called upon to do the fighting and dying. There would be very much less sense in having a 76-year-old president of a munitions factory or a flat-footed head of an international banking firm or the cross-eyed manager of a uniform manufacturing plant, all of whom see visions of tremendous profits in the event of war, voting on whether the nation should go to war or not. They never could be called upon to shoulder arms, to sleep in a trench, and to be shot. Only those who would be called upon to risk their lives for their country should have the privilege of voting to determine whether the nation should go to war. And you know, that's true. That's true. But at the same time, folks, right now we have a voluntary army. We got more morons in Congress than any other place in the world. And we got these Tea Party people and these so-called patriot people who would go to war, who would stand behind Obama, stand behind any president, go to war, right? And they'll go over there and get blown up. Their sons and daughters will get blown up, and they'll die, okay? Or they'll come back complete shattered. And, so I disagree in many ways with letting those people go, because they'd want to go anyway, you know? Let's have some rational, intelligent people do it, okay? And I don't know if that exists anymore. I don't know if we have rationally intelligent people left in this country. Man, you wouldn't think so by looking at it. There is ample precedent for restricting the voting for those affected. Many of our states have restrictions on those permitted to vote. In most, it is necessary to be able to read and write before you can vote. In some, you must own property. It would be a simple matter each year for the men coming out of military age to register in their communities as they did in the draft during the World War and be examined physically. Those who could pass and who would thereafter be called upon to bear arms in the event of war would be eligible to vote in a limited plebiscite. They should be the ones to have the power to decide, and not a Congress. Few of those members are within the age limit, and it's fewer still of whom are in physical condition to bear arms, and only those who must suffer should have the right to vote. A third step in this business of smashing the war racket is to make certain that our military forces are truly forces of defense only. At each session of Congress, the question of further naval appropriations come up. The Swivel Chair Admirals of Washington, and there are always a lot of them, are very adroit lobbyists, and they are smart. They don't shout that we need a lot of battleships to war on this nation or that nation. Oh, no. First of all, they let it be known that America is menaced by a great naval power. Almost any day, these admirals will tell you, the great fleet of this supposed enemy will suddenly strike and annihilate 125 million American people. Just like that. Then they begin to cry for a larger navy. For what? To fight the enemy. Oh, my, no. No, oh no, for defense purposes only. Then, incidentally, they announced maneuvers in the Pacific for defense. Well, the Pacific is a great big ocean. We have a tremendous coastline on the Pacific. Will the maneuvers be off the coast to 300 miles or no? The maneuvers will be 2,000, yes, perhaps even 3,500 miles off the coast. Well, the Japanese, a proud people, of course, will be pleased beyond expression to see the United States fleet so close to Nippon's shores, and even as pleased as would be the residents of California, where they too dimly discern through the morning this Japanese fleet playing at war games off Los Angeles. The ships of our Navy, it can be seen, should be specifically limited by law within 200 miles off of our coastline. Had that been the law in 1898, the Maine would never have gone to Havana Harbor. She never would have been blown up, and there would have been no war with Spain and its attendant loss of life. 200 miles is ample. In the opinion of experts for defense purposes, our nation cannot start an offensive war if its ships can't go further than 200 miles from the coastline. And planes might be permitted to go as far as 500 miles from the coast for purposes of reconnaissance, and the Army should never leave the territorial limits of our nation. Now, that's interesting, isn't it, folks? To summarize, three steps must be taken to smash the war racket. We must take the profit out of war. We must permit the youth of the land with bare arms to decide whether or not there should be war. And we must limit our military forces to home defense purposes. Okay? Now, there's nothing happening like that today. Nothing. our fleet is all over the goddamn world protecting everybody, and if we're not, and not charging anything. We're in every foreign country. We've got 1,000 bases or something like that all around the world. Military, naval, you name it. And it's just a huge, massive waste, and we're getting nothing from it. And the final chapter is to hell with war. I'm not a fool as to believe that war is a thing of the past. I know the people do not want war, but there is no use in saying they cannot be pushed into another war. Looking back, Woodrow Wilson was reelected president in 1916 on a platform that he had kept us out of war and on the implied promise that he would keep us out of war. Yet 5 months later, he asked Congress to declare war on Germany. In that five-month interval, the people had not been asked whether they had changed their minds. The 4 million young men who put on uniforms and marched or sailed away were not asked whether they wanted to go further to suffer and die. Then what caused our government to change its mind so suddenly? Money. an Allied commission, it may be recalled, came over shortly before the war declaration and called on the president. The president summoned a group of advisors. The head of the commission spoke, stripped his diplomatic language. This is what he told the president and his group. There is no use kidding ourselves any longer. The cause of the Allies is lost. We now owe you, American bankers, American munitions makers, American manufacturers, American speculators, American exporters, $5 or $6 billion. If we lose, and without the help of the United States, we must lose, we, England, France, and Italy, cannot pay back this money, and Germany won't. So, had secrecy been outlawed as far as war negotiations were concerned, and had the press been invited to be present at the conference, or had radio been available to broadcast the proceedings, America never would have entered the war. But this conference, like all war discussions, was shrouded in utmost secrecy. When our boys were sent off to war, they were told it was a war to make the end of the world safe, to make the world safe for democracy, and a war to end all wars. Well, 18 years later, the world is less of a democracy than it had been. Besides, what business it is of ours whether Russia or Germany or England or France or Italy or Austria live under democracies or monarchies, whether they are fascists or communists, our problem is to preserve our own democracy. And very little, if anything, has been accomplished to assure us that the World War was really the war to end all wars. Yes, we have had disarmament conferences and limitations of arms conferences. They don't mean a thing. One has just failed. The results of another have been nullified. And we send our professional soldiers and our sailors and our politicians and our diplomats to these conferences. And what happens? The professional soldiers and sailors don't want to disarm. No admiral wants to be without a ship. No general wants to be without a command. Both mean men without jobs. They are not for disarmament. They cannot be for limitations of arms. And at all these conferences lurking in the background, but all powerful, just the same, are the sinister agents of those who profit by war. They see to it that these conferences do not disarm or seriously limit armaments. The chief aim of any power at any of these conferences has not been to achieve disarmament to prevent war, but rather to get more armament for itself and less for any potential foe. There is only one way to disarm with any semblance of practicability, there, and that is for all nations to get together and scrap every ship, every gun, every rifle, every tank, every warplane. Even this, if it is possible, would not be enough. The next war, according to experts, will be fought not with battleships, not by artillery, not with rifles, not with machine guns. It will be fought with deadly chemicals and gases. Secretly, each nation is studying and perfecting newer and ghastlier means of annihilating its foes wholesale. Yes, ships all continue to be built for the shipbuilders, but must make their profits. And guns still will be manufactured, and powder and rifle will be paid. For the munitions makers must make their huge profits. And the soldiers, of course, must wear uniforms, for the manufacturer must make their war profits, too. But victory or defeat will be determined by the skill and ingenuity of our scientists. If we put them to work making poison gas and more fiendish mechanical and explosive instruments of destruction, they will have no time for the construction jobs or building greater prosperity for all people by putting them to this useful job. We can all make more money out of peace than we can out of war, even the munition makers. So I say, to hell with war. And that's the war is a racket, folks. Right at 9 o'clock. Boy, that's a perfect time. But you might want to go to that. Like I said, you can just go to warisaracket.com and you can get the whole book. It's only 5 chapters long. You can download it and have it for yourself. Share it with your friends. friends and share it with your family, you know, and but as I say, I want to thank everybody who listened tonight. Tell your friends about it. If you want a copy of this, embed it in your website, do whatever you want with it. Might be a good thing to let people know what this brave American said, this General Smedley Butler, all right, said about it in 1935. Still holds true to this day. You know, it's just absolutely amazing. And our sociopathic son of a bitch president, okay, keeps sending us his troops to war, keeps sending people, keeps involving us with wars, keeps involving us with everything, tries to build a police state in this country. Folks, the man's got to get it. We got to get this guy out of there. I don't know how we're going to do it. I swear I don't know, but I'm open for ideas. And people just got to be so mad. We just got to get so mad that we march by the millions on the White House, take it over, send these guys, put these guys, try them publicly on the steps of the White House, on the steps of Congress, try each one of them for war crimes, try them for theft, try them for treason, and, you know, have them and arrest them. Have the citizens, mass citizen arrest of everyone in Congress, all the lobbyists, all the crooks, all the treasonous bastards, you know, and just do it. That's all you got to do. That's the revolution, folks. That's the revolution. We got to be strong enough to do it. We'll, but, you know, how many people are going to sit on their ass, play with their iPhones, you know, who cares, you know, eat a Twinkie, anyway, good night, everybody, thanks for listening, and talk to you next week.